Most people would agree that mothers are influential in shaping their children's outlook on life. A recent study discloses a new facet of maternal influence. Maternal immune cells teach those of the fetus how to balance the need for self-defense on the one hand and the requirement for immunologic tolerance on the other. Balance is critical. Too much restraint of immunity could lead to a lethal infection in the newborn. Too little could lead to autoimmunity. What a marvel are mothers and the pathway toward tolerance they map out for us before we are born. That's an excerpt from an article by William Burlingham in the New England Journal of Medicine from March 2009. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Why is it that a mother tolerates a fetus rather than rejecting it as a foreign body? How can the delicate balance of immunity between mother and child help scientists understand the process of tissue and organ rejection after transplants? As doctors perform more and more kidney, lung, and heart transplants, what new information is coming out about the breakdown of tolerance to one's own tissues as a result of transplantation? Joining us to discuss tolerance and transplantation is Will Burlingham, professor of surgery and a transplant researcher at the UW-Madison.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you, Norman, Emily.
Before we get into what seems almost this miraculous relationship between maternal and fetal immune systems and tolerance, I really have to tip my hat to all of those who were the first recipient of any kind of transplant, and a secondary tip of the hat to those who conducted the transplant. How long has this been going on?
Well, you know, there was a painting back in the 17th century or 16th century of a St. Cosmos and St. Damien performing a surgical attachment of a new limb from, of course, a totally different race to a Egyptian or something like that. And it wasn't really clear how that turned out. But that's sort of the one everybody starts with. You could think of modern transplantation as dating from the mid-1950s when a kidney was taken from one identical twin and put into another at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. But I like to think that the study of transplantation really begins here in the University of Wisconsin in 1945. Then there was a fellow by the name of Ray Owen who's still living. He's out in Pasadena, California now. But he discovered that during pregnancy of a cow, when you have what they call a free Martin situation, which is where a female and a male are born together, they're not identical, obviously, the female always develops weak udders and is always infertile because of the fact that in the cow, the placenta from the individual twins has fused. So the blood mixture from the male causes the females not to develop.
They're sort of compromised. Mm.
They're compromised. So what Ray was interested in was, well, what about their blood types? You know, would their blood types be separate as we usually expect them to be because they're not identical? Or would they be somehow mixed? And what he found was that each of these twins, he studied 80 of them, was a mixture of the other twin, which meant that into adult life they were actually two different individuals that had mixed. So that was the first known successful transplant, and that was an act of nature.
So there's a kind of close relationship, I guess, between the science behind why a mother doesn't reject the fetus and then what you're able to do if you transplant a kidney or a heart or a lung. Maybe we can start with that. Why doesn't a mother reject the fetus as a foreign body? What is it that happens sort of immunologically that makes that work?
There are a lot of answers to that question, and we could say we don't know all the answers for sure, but one of them is the physical separation of mother from baby. So mother's blood bathes the placenta, and baby gets all of the nutrients through there, but there's no actual connection between mother's circulation and baby's circulation, unlike the case in the cattle, the fetal twins. So mother's cells have to move across that placenta, and babies have to move across the other way. Do they do this? Yes. But by the time the immune system of mother catches up with what's going on, it's already late in term three and, baby's being born. So a lot of times complications of that nature only happen late in pregnancy if mother does react. So there's a physical separation. But now there's more and more evidence that there's sort of – there's chemical things going on and molecular things that are protecting baby. So, for example, there are things along that interface between the decidium where the baby implants, unusual things going on there. There's different enzymes that are active in that area that are actually limiting the ability of the immune system to react there. So we call this immune privilege. There's a term for it. And there are certain places that it happens in nature. For instance, the anterior chamber of the eye is an immune privileged site. It's very difficult to mount an immune response in your eye, and that's a good thing because, you know, we want the eye to be clear. Vision is very important to us, right? So there are certain restrictions there as far as the anatomy and chemically.
Let me see if I understand it. So this, if your eye is immune privileged, it doesn't respond as actively to foreign bodies then?
Correct. And in fact, early work in the field of cancer immune responses was done by injecting tumors into the eye of a rabbit to grow them because they can grow there. They won't grow anywhere else because the rabbit would reject them. But you can grow most any kind of tumor in that anterior chamber because the immune system says, no, we're not going to attack that.
So as far as finding out more about the relationship between mother and child, it surprises me at first thought that even a mother and a child could have different blood types. But you say that they are that separate from each other, and yet there's some kind of chemical interaction.
Well, of course, we're not completely different from our mothers. That's part of the secret, I think, of this acceptance, is that we're half the same, right? So we have half of the genes on our body come from mother. The other half from father is, of course, different, and mother can recognize those as different. And the half that we didn't inherit from mother is also different from us. So that half is the part that we call those the non-inherited maternal antigens. And that's where we think the baby is really focusing its this business of tolerance, of acceptance on allowing mother cells to enter the baby's body and stay there throughout life.
At the end of the article that you just published in the New England Journal, the one that I read an excerpt from, the last sentence you have where you write, "What a marvel are mothers and the pathway toward tolerance they map out for us." What sort of pathway toward tolerance do they map out for us? What do you mean by that?
We like to think of our immune system as a benefit to us, right? Because without it,
we'd be sick.
Right? But it's really kind of like a bunch of parasites that are living in our body as kind of like a commensal organism. They can live with us, and they will destroy all kinds of invasive things in our body, but they can also destroy us, right? So we've developed this evolutionary relationship with these things that we call the immune system, and part of that is this balance existing. So we have whole sets of genes that revolve around suppressing our own immune system. Once we get rid of that virus or once we get rid of that bacteria, these cells come in like gangbusters, and they're all over the place protecting all the other sensitive structures in our bodies from any further attack because these are motley mobs of cells that do this, and sometimes they can aim at things that we don't want them to aim at. And for the most part, this system works very well. But I think that part of the reason it works so well and that, you know, 95% of us anyways don't get autoimmunity is because mother is the first antigen, if you will. She's the first foreign thing that we see. And we know how much to react to her and how much not to by this developing interaction with her during pregnancy and then in nursing.
So essentially, there's a balance between these autoimmune problems or attacks.
Right.
And not having any defense, which can be a problem in a transplant if you're trying to suppress an adverse reaction to a transplanted organ.
Right. We have to defend ourselves. It's clear. We have to defend ourselves against viruses and against other pathogens. So when people were thinking of how to do this thing called transplantation, they realized that if they suppress the immune system too much, sure, we wouldn't reject the transplanted organ, but we'd also get very sick and come down with all kinds of problems, which, of course, We do, and it's particularly seen in the elderly still today. I mean, the elderly who get a transplant are 4 times more likely to die of flu or of other complications that elderly people can handle. But that said, I think we're not a pristine kind of a environment. It's once been said that I think there's 10 billion cells in our body, but more than half of them aren't ours. You know, they're these...
That explains a lot.
Yeah, these bacteria that live in our gut, for instance, are very numerous, in some cases very essential to our health, and yet we don't attack them, and we have various different strategies for not attacking them. And I think, you know, when mother comes in through breastfeeding, mother's cells and her antigens present in the milk are also teaching the baby, okay, this is an area where you can allow certain cells to exist so long as they don't attack you. And for the most part, mother's cells don't attack us, and these commensal organisms in our gut don't attack us either.
In fact, we need some of those invaders, if you want to call them that, or visitors.
Exactly. And if you're a cow, you need them to survive because they break down the cellulose and those sorts of things and allow the cow to make milk.
And if we look at some of the early attempts at doing transplants and why they failed, mostly they failed because the immune system wasn't suppressed enough?
Yes. I mean, if you could say, if you go back to Damien and Cosmos, they didn't have immunosuppression, so they would have failed because of that. The first heart transplant, for example, was done in South Africa in 1967 by a guy named Christian Barnard. It's a very remarkable story because nobody expected that that would happen there first. But once the heart was going and once the system was working, he really didn't know how much of this drug, steroids, which is what they had corticosteroids to give the patient at the time. They had very little in their way of arsenal. Today, you know, instead of one drug or two drugs, we have 50 different immunosuppressive drugs to give. Well, maybe 50 is an exaggeration, but there's a large variety of more all the time. And because of that, it was like giving a sledgehammer to a guy who was already sick, trying to revive by having a new heart, a very sick body, and the opportunistic infections killed that first heart transplantation.
Over a course of, was it a few days or weeks?
It was about 2 weeks, I think, he lasted.
Is there an advantage of transplanting one organ over the other? I mean, was there a particular reason to start, say, with a kidney transplant as opposed to a lung transplant?
I would say that the reason the kidney transplants were the first was because we've got two kidneys. And so you or I or Emily can donate a kidney to someone that we love and care about, and or if we happen to be an identical twin in the case, you can still do well with the kidney that you have. It's a little bit more problematic when you get to an organ like the liver, which can only be divided surgically. And so when you say, you know, you ask for people to raise their hand if they want to be a kidney donor, a lot of people raise their hand. If you say, well, we need a liver donor, I don't know if the same people would raise their hands knowing what's involved because there's a chance of mortality.
For both participants?
For both. You could have, as the surgeons call it, 200% mortality, which is not good. So that's a sort of a technical answer. But I think in general—
In the case of the liver, though, excuse me, but it would be part of the liver, presumably, that you're transplanting and then it regenerates to some extent?
Right, exactly. In fact, we had a recent case here of a young girl who got a liver transplant from her dad, and dad works here at the university, and it's been a great success. But the liver is a special organ in a way that we really are fascinated with immunologically because it's not only regenerates, you know, so that the donor and the recipient can recover, but it also, it's very, what we call tolerogenic. So like mother, it sort of convinces the immune system of the host to accept it. And so there are a number of people who are walking around with liver transplants and not taking any immunosuppression.
How important is it to match a donor's organ, and why is that? Let's say you're going to have a kidney transplant and you hear about people getting their siblings in and trying to find which one matches. Right. What exactly are they looking for, and how important is that there be a match?
In the early days back in the 1940s when Ray Owen was studying matching, he was studying red cell matching. And of course, red cells, the ABO system is very important. We need to match that because if we don't, there'll be antibodies that will right away wreak havoc with the organ. But once we get past that, the next major gene is the HLA complex, as it's called, which is on the sixth chromosome. And those genes have been mapped out by a professor here, Dr. Bob DeMars, very in great detail, and others, of course. But those HLA antigens are the ones that when we talk about matching, or you hear about people getting a bone marrow transplant that's matched, they're talking about that particular chromosome. Even if we match for those, however, the graft can still reject because all the other chromosomes are still different, and they contribute somewhat what we call minor histocompatibility loci, but if you add them all up, they can also cause the damage. But by far the best results are with a kidney from a sibling. Give a large family, so your chances are 1 in 4 that one of your siblings is going to have the same HLA, same 6th chromosome for mom and dad. Those are by far the best in terms of long-term survival.
And let's say you put one of those organs in, mm-hmm. like a kidney, and you've done the transplant. If rejection is going to happen, how quickly does it happen, and what exactly is happening sort of in the body?
Those are very good questions. Well, the first thing is we know from animal models that within 7 to 10 days, say in a monkey kidney transplant, those kidneys will reject, and probably if left untended, that would happen as well. Because we give people immune suppressive drugs, we delay that from happening, usually till 2 or 3 weeks. An interesting feature about mother, this is just kind of on the topic of that, when you get a kidney from mother or from a sibling that has mother's non-inherited antigens, these sort of magical antigens that we've been exposed to, those rejections tend to happen a lot quicker. And that's sort of paradoxical because I'm telling you that, it's actually good to have that kind of a transplant. But what we think is happening is there's two different elements to our immune system. There's what we call the memory cells that have seen antigen before, and then the naive cells that haven't yet seen the antigen. Well, we've got memory cells from mother. Remember, mother teaches us both rejection, how to reject her, as well as how to tolerate her. So we have both. We have a balance of both. And so when we see those early rejections, sometimes it's a good sign because it means we're getting these out of the way and now we can get into the tolerance mode. So that's a long answer to your question. What causes the rejection are mainly we think of this as coming from our T lymphocytes and our B lymphocytes. I don't know how much your audience knows about this, but the T lymphocytes are the ones that are responsible for what we call delayed hypersensitivity, such as when you get a rash from poison ivy. That's a T cell driven response. And that response involves T cells as well as a number of other accessory cells that go in slowly. That's a more slow developing. That's why it's called delayed. And then there are the B cells, which is a very rapid thing. Once you make a B cell makes an antibody, it attacks the kidney, and you can get very rapid onset of problems.
We'll look at some discoveries that have come from transplants, specific mm-hmm. transplants, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from UW Extension, Division of Continuing Education, Outreach, and E-Learning, now managing the online Bachelor of Science degree in Sustainable Management. Information is at sustain.wisconsin.edu.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Will Burlingham, and we're talking about tolerance and transplantation. There was a story in the State Journal some years ago about one of your patients, Rayburn DeHart, one of the mm-hmm. people you had studied as part mm-hmm. of your transplant research, making headlines as one of the early kidney transplant patients at University Hospital. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about her story and what you learned from it?
Rayburn was a real pioneer. She was the second patient ever to receive a kidney transplant in the state of Wisconsin. She was done right here at the hospital. And back in 1967, very little was known about the long-term effects of immune suppression. We knew that you had to take the immune suppressive drugs so you didn't have this acute kind of rejection in the first few weeks of transplant. But back then, it really wasn't known how long a person had it taken. Rayburn was just a wonderful person, had a lot of joy of living, had a very difficult time because she had obviously, to go through the whole business of dialysis before there was really any sophisticated dialysis equipment. So she was one of the first dialysis patients also. So she regarded every bit of life as a gift. And when she finally got her transplant, she went for 5 years with taking the drugs as prescribed and then responded to a questionnaire about compliance, because they were concerned at that time about whether patients were still taking the drugs, and said that she had stopped taking her drugs as an experiment to hopefully benefit other patients. Well, that's a pretty risky experiment to do. And at the time, of course, everybody was saying, don't do this. But she turned up in about 30 years later in a questionnaire, kind of, again, another survey, as one of our oldest living transplant recipients, and was asked, you know, how is she doing? And she said, I'm doing fine. And how much drugs are you taking? And she said, I'm not taking any. And so we started studying her. And between our lab and a group in the Netherlands, which was studying the particular kinds of antigens that were different between her and her sister, who was the donor, we managed to figure out how exactly she was doing it.
That sister was one of several siblings that you had to choose from, so
right.
That sister was very specifically selected for that transplant.
Correct.
And yet there was a difference.
Right. So as I said earlier, the main locus that causes tissue rejection between individuals is this thing called HLA, which is on the sixth chromosome. And they had the same sixth chromosome for mom and dad. They could figure that out back then. They didn't have real sophisticated DNA techniques, but they could figure it out by some very primitive serologic tests that they did. So once they knew that, they knew it was going to be a good transplant. What they didn't know was all the other differences. And this took a long time to figure out, and it turned out right around 1999, which is the time that she showed up, the first paper had been published on some of these other antigens were, and she happened to be a complete mismatch for this one that had been discovered. So it's sort of like somebody gives you a flashlight and says, go looking for something, and the only place you can shine your flashlight is right here, and it turns out that's where they differed. So we were quite lucky, because, you know, had it been some other antigen, we wouldn't have been able to study her. So yeah, they had a lot to choose from. They chose the best match. They even had a brother in Vietnam at the time who they brought back from Vietnam to type, and he wasn't the right type, but he got out of Vietnam for a while, which was good for him. Once we knew that there was an antigen there, we started studying it, and it turns out her mother had this antigen. She didn't have it, so that would have been one of the antigens that she had not inherited from her mother. Her baby, which actually had put her into the tailspin of chronic kidney failure, which happens sometimes in women who have children, that baby also had the antigen. So here she got exposed from her mother, from the baby, and now her sister had a double dose of this antigen. So she had a lot of exposure to this throughout her life. And we think that because of that, the T cells that could normally have gone in and rejected the transplant were unable to do so because of these what we call suppressive or regulatory T cells that were all put in place by mother originally in her and then just amplified over time.
Now, you said that she stopped taking the anti-rejection drugs 5 years after her transplant.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think if she had stopped taking them right away, it still would have been all right?
You know, she might have rejected if she had dropped it too soon. I think there is a period of time, was particularly what happens, the physical things that happen to a transplanted tissue when you take it out of one organ or one individual and put it into another are very damaging. So there's a lot of just by disconnecting it from its original life source and then before you can reconnect it, all kinds of things are happening that cause the immune system to regard this as a huge inflammatory environment, and that they will go after things that they normally wouldn't react to, say, in a resting kidney. So yeah, during that early period of time, most people feel that it's essential that the patient take some kind of immunosuppression.
I guess it does point out the fact that each person is an individual.
Mm-hmm.
After all. I mean, no matter how close you can match, there still is going to be some variation from one individual to the next.
Absolutely.
And is there a danger that people who would hear this story and think, oh, she lived to 79 and she didn't take her drugs, mm-hmm. that they would be encouraged to go off medication when, in fact, it might not be the right thing for most transplant patients?
Right. We don't want that impression to get out there. In fact, what we want to do is to study these folks who have made it through. And they're only, you know, 5%, 95% don't make it through. But by studying these folks who do, we hope to be able to now go back and say to the doc, okay, look, this individual who's taking three different drugs really doesn't need to have all three. Maybe they only need one, you know, or maybe only need two. But to try to personalize and individualize medical treatment, I think it's really going to help our whole healthcare system a lot, because then we won't be creating more problems due to the immunosuppression and over-treating somebody, and we won't be spending as much money on unnecessary treatments.
How are various organs – I don't know how much difference there would be from one to the other in terms of the way they're preserved or maintained when they're en route from one patient to another? I mean, we hear about, you know, organs being airlifted from mm-hmm. one patient to another. What all is involved there in the organ preparation for transplant?
Well, I'm speaking as an immunologist now, but there are very excellent people who have worked on this here. In fact, the UW solution is one of the premier organ preservation solutions in the world, and that was developed here by Dr. Belser and Dr. Jim Southard back in 1985, 86. But that enables you to take an organ that's disconnected from the original donor. You perfuse it with this liquid, and it acts to keep the organ in balance and keep all the tissues alive.
Even a heart?
Even a heart transplant. Now, the heart is a little bit different because there you have different preservation requirements. So I would say kidneys can be stored and shipped for long distances. Hearts are quite a bit less able to be shipped that far.
What about lungs? I know you've done some work on
lungs. Lungs are actually pretty good, I believe. In fact, from what Dr. Love and Dr. Meyer tell me, you know, because the lungs are so well perfused with oxygen, you can actually harvest them when the other organs are not worth harvesting. So they do tend to preserve pretty well. The problem, though, is that whatever preservation damage you have put in, you have now to deal with the immunologic consequences of that damage on the other end. And in the case of the lung, that damage releases something that we call collagen 5, which is normally not accessible to the immune system, and allows the immune system to look at this. And we get into very, very severe problems down the line in lung transplant because of that.
What is collagen 5?
Collagen is made up of a variety of different kinds. And again, I'm not an expert on collagen. I work with Dan Greenspan here, who is an expert, but what the basic idea is, you have the major collagen is collagen type 1 that was described long ago by Linus Pauling, and has a triple helix. You know, so the DNA has a double helix. This one has a triple helix. It's very stable stuff. But in order to make that very stable material the same each time, you have to have a little sort of a stacker inside of it that allows just the right amount of that twisted rope, if you will, to be made so that all of your fibers come out the exact same diameter. And collagen 5 is that little stacking agent. It's another kind of collagen. It's only 1%, where the other kinds are 99%, but it's hidden inside the fiber. When you have damage to a lung or to a vessel, for example, the collagen fibers come open, and those pieces that we call these collagen 5 fibers get out, and the immune system can attack those. So now you have two problems, because you have the problem of HLA, which when you're doing a lung transplant or a liver transplant, you're not dealing with siblings here. You're dealing with quite unrelated individuals. So you get the immune system recognizing that. Plus, you have this new antigen that the immune system hasn't seen or has kind of been ignoring that can also cause you to react to it. So you have what we call alloimmunity, which is the immunity to something, to a foreign HLA, and autoimmunity, which is immunity to something that's in your own body, both focused on that poor organ that's been stuck into this person. And so this is the kind of things that we're now trying to deal with in transplant.
How do you prepare a patient for a transplant you can't really 100% know how they're going to react, can you, to an organ that's put in from outside?
This is actually a very good question. In principle, we think of ourselves as not having experienced any transplants before we come to the table and we present ourselves to surgeons saying, I need a kidney graft. But in fact, we have a history of being transplanted by our mother. So our mother has transplanted cells into us. Those cells have particular antigens. The antigens depend on who our mother happens to be. As long as our mother is not what we call homozygous, which would be if we're highly, highly inbred and mother's got all the same antigens, that we got nothing different. But most of us have mothers that are not. And so we have a history of actually being exposed to that antigen and doing something about it. And in fact, what we find is that people are naturally inclined to suppress their reaction against mother. So let's say if somebody comes into transplant, you want to test them before they get the transplant. You could assess whether some of those antigens or some of those markers that are on the kidney that they're going to get might also be the same as the ones that mother had put into the body, and if their reaction is one of acceptance rather than rejection.
So what would you give them, like a injection, some blood or?
Well, no, you just take their white cells out of them. You don't have to do this in their body.
Okay.
You can take them out and do the experiment in a dish or in a microwell, or as we like to in our lab, we insert the cells into the foot pad of a mouse.
And if it's going to react, you see inflammation? What do you see?
Well, I'll give you the case of the foot pad in the mouse because it's the easiest one. What happens if you have a reaction against something, if I take some of your cells and I mix in something that you're particularly primed up against, say tetanus. You've had your tetanus shots up to date. What will happen in the foot pad of that mouse is that these cells will release factors that cause the mouse to send all kinds of inflammatory cells and will swell that foot pad up so that we can measure a different shoe size essentially on the mouse. So the mouse goes from a size 8 to a size 10 and we say, okay, there's a positive reaction, and we'll give that a number, 20 or 30. And then what we do is we say, okay, here's your donor, right, that might be mother or might be a sibling or might be someone else that has some of those antigens. We'll take a little bit of those cells and we'll mix it in there with your cells and the tetanus. And if you have a suppressive reaction against those cells from mother, what will happen is that instead of swelling up to a 20, maybe it'll only go up to a 5, mm-hmm. right? Which means that something in there is clamping down now on that inflammation and telling us that the person really has a tendency to want to regulate against that particular donor. Other people you might be sensitized to in advance. For example, if a mother is getting a kidney from a daughter or a son to whom they have become immunized by pregnancy, it might go the other way, where that, you know, foot pad will swell up just by interacting with those cells, in which case we say, well, that's not such a good deal for that particular individual.
How long does that sort of thing take? I mean, is there such a thing as an emergency kidney transplant or an emergency lung transplant where you'd have to hurry this whole process? And if so, how short, I guess, could you make it?
Well, in general, these are not emergent procedures. That's in general. I mean, there are people that are very, very sick and need a transplant right away. But for the most part, that's not the case. So you have time. Our tissue typing lab can turn around results in easily within 6 to 8 hours, can tell you what the match is, whether they are matched or not. They can also tell you, for instance, if a person has antibodies already in their body against that donor. And this is a very important no-no. We really want to be sure that any kidney we put in isn't going to get attacked right away by an antibody. So those kinds of tests are also done routinely within hours, and you know, decisions can be made to call in the person for the transplant or to call it off.
How long does it take that mouse's foot to swell up? I imagine somebody waiting.
Right. So that test takes 24 hours. Mm-hmm. But that's a test that we developed in our lab. That's not a standard test that's used in tissue typing labs. Tissue typing labs don't have mouse cages around. In fact, that's a difficulty with that particular test. The tissue typing labs have DNA-based techniques and in plastic techniques that they do. But they can turn that around within, like I say, within hours.
You hear about transplants sometimes of pieces from animals, you know, like pig valves or, you know, which seems kind of an amazing concept that you could take something and get somehow a tolerance of something from a different species.
Well, that's true. But we here you got to distinguish between two different types of things. There's living tissue, which has, you know, all of these sorts of collagen, but they also have cells living in them, heart cells and so forth. And then there's inanimate structures. So, for instance, a pig valve is basically like a piece of leather or a solid thing that doesn't have pig cells in it, as I understand, at least mainly doesn't have pig cells in it. And so what you want the immune system to do is just kind of ignore that. It's not as difficult for the immune system to handle that kind of a thing. But if you put a whole pig organ, which people want to do, in fact, people have tried kidney transplants from pigs, there you have a different problem because you're almost naturally allergic to these organs. That is to say, it's like having an ABO incompatible organ donor where, you know, you have already antibodies to the pig. All of us have this. And so that's a different area.
It sounds as if you'd be taking drugs for a long time.
Well, yeah, and that will, I think, only come about – that kind of thing will only come about through genetic engineering of pigs where you can create various different kinds of pig breeds that ultimately will not either express those antigens or will be programmed to not self-destruct when they encounter the immune system of the human.
Another area of research is stem cells and how they might affect transplantation. We'll talk about that and other matters when we continue in a moment with the University of the Year.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Focus on Energy, helping Wisconsin residents and businesses explore the use of renewable energy such as solar, wind, and biomass. More information on renewable energy options for home or business at focusonenergy.com.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Will Burlingham. And we're looking at the phenomenon of organ transplants and the difficulties and now some of the things that might make it a lot simpler to find a match, donor and recipient. And we mentioned stem cells. Is that really going to revolutionize organ transplanting?
Well, clearly, if you could generate an organ from a stem cell, that would be fantastic. Yeah, because
absolute compatibility.
No problem with compatibility, no problem with mismatching of antigens. Probably that's going to come about first with tissues rather than organs because tissues are a little maybe less complicated in some ways. I know there's a lot of interest in generating, say, islets of Langerhans, the ones that produce insulin for diabetics. If you could take, for example, the skin from the diabetic and generate a stem cell out of that, and then from that stem cell give rise to the beta cells, then you'd
the beta cells being the ones that actually channel it off into developing an organ of, or some specific structure?
Well, they're the ones ultimately that you want. Those are the ones that produce insulin, but there are pathways leading to that. One of our surgeons in our Department of Surgery, John Odorico, is working with Jamie Thompson on this project of trying to guide the stem cells into that pathway. So that's, I think, going to happen. But I think, you know, as far as trying to generate a very complex organ like the kidney from stem cells, that's many years away, I think.
It would take time to develop it.
But could somehow the stem cells help in not rejecting an organ, sort of if you could inject stem cells that were, I don't know, in effect, less likely to attack other cells, sort of more immunoaccepting cells. Because if I remember right, the kidney transplant that you talked about, the patient that lived so long, going along with her sister's kidney came some extra cells that helped her fight off things?
That was not this particular transplant.
That was a different
one. It was a different one. But no, you've hit a good point there. One of the things that happened in the mid-1980s, which at that time revolutionized the whole field of living donor transplantation, is giving blood cells, blood transfusions. And it was found that people who got a lot of blood transfusions actually did better than people who didn't. And from that came this thing that we call donor-specific transfusions, where mother not only donates a kidney but also gives several pints of blood that go transfused into the recipient prior to getting the graft. There's a group at Harvard who's now doing that with stem cells. And they basically are taking stem cells out of the bone marrow of the donor and putting them into this recipient, allowing those cells to engraft, and then putting the kidney in. And they've reported, I think, half a dozen patients off all of their drugs with good kidney function.
That's pretty exciting.
It's very exciting, yeah.
I would think with more and more data from around the world, you know, more specific information about different patients and matches and so on, that you could have a better system of getting the right organ to the right donor. I mean, how widespread is sharing now?
Well, it just became a little less widespread. There's an organization called the United Network for Organ Sharing, which is for the United States in charge of all sharing between centers. And back in 1987, they mandated that if you had a perfect match, that is all, and we call that, there's six different loci that we really match for a lot in the HLA. If you have all six the same, that kidney goes to the individual with that particular set of numbers, sort of like winning the lottery. You know, you get your six numbers all line up the same. And then in 1995, they allowed a little bit more sharing. You don't have to match for all six numbers, but just so long as you don't have any mismatches for any of the six, which opened up it a little bit more.
And why is that? Just because it's easier to use the immune suppressant drugs and that kind of thing? Or why did they actually loosen up the criteria?
Well, I think that our typing got better. That is to say, one of the problems with doing this is, of course, if your typing is not good, let's say you're 25% inaccurate about your typing, you're going to mess up from time to time and you're not really going to have a match, as you said. But our typing has gotten so good. And since the early 1990s, we do DNA typing as well as serologic typing. So we really know exactly what's going on with the genetics of these two individuals. You can be pretty sure if you don't have a mismatch with them that it's going to be a very good outcome. So, you know, that was mandated up until last year. And the real reason for the change, I think, was because, well, I should say, not all of organ sharing is now gone, but we only share for pediatrics, for children, and for what we call highly sensitized people. These are people who have made antibodies to different HLAs, and they're almost impossible to transplant unless they get a perfect kidney match. And so for those individuals and the pediatrics, we still do shipping from far distances to find those. What it does from the surgeon standpoint, it allows the surgeon more flexibility. So if they want to put a liver and a kidney from the same donor, they can do that more easily, for example.
And more immediately,
yeah, because it's local.
Right there.
Yeah.
I would think there'd be such competition for organs. It must be very difficult in any given case
to determine a fair system.
Yeah. Who gets what?
And in the state of Wisconsin, as you may know, we have one of the highest, if not the highest, rates of organ donation per capita of any state. So, you know, if you say, well, there are certain states that have a very low rate of donating organs, but they have a high number of people needing organs, then, you know, if you too much sharing, all these organs are going to go from Wisconsin to wherever, you know, Texas or somewhere, and you may not want that to happen. So there's balances built into the system. But I would like to see happening in the future is people are going to be living donors are going to want that kidney to go into a very well-matched individual and have their loved one, whoever it is that they're wanting to get a kidney, get a better match than the one that they can offer. So there you would have to get into a kind of a sharing network of living donors who are all sort of altruistically saying, okay, well,
catch,
you know what?
I
want my kidney to – I want this person that I love to get a kidney, but I'd prefer it if she could get a really well-matched one. So I'm going to put mine into the pool, and then they'll swap it around until we get the best one for her. And that – I think that's already happening to some extent, but I think that's going to happen more in the future as we – find that, you know, there's an organ donor shortage and there's not that many kidneys to go around, but you really want the best kidney to go to the best recipient.
Is kidney the only organ that would go from a – well, liver we mentioned also, from a living recipient to a transplant recipient?
Well, you mean in terms of living donation?
Yes. Surviving the donation.
Right.
Well, bone
so
marrow?
There's living – of course, bone marrow transplantation, you can actually have a bone marrow bank, you know, so people can donate their bone marrow into a bank and then have it go to complete, to good matched people. Lung, actually, there's living donor lung transplantation, what they call LOBES, where they take a lobar transplant and do that. And that's only done in a few centers because, again, there's a 200% mortality possibility there. The living donor liver transplants are somewhat specialized. There are certain centers that do them. Our center is one that does them, and I think that's going to become more common. But I should say something about liver. Liver is really breaks all of the rules. So when you start to talk about matching is not nearly as important in liver as it is in other organs. And that's really not clear why, but it seems that the liver just generates its own acceptance.
So are we talking about a situation in which, again, some altruistic person would say, well, if somebody out there really needs it, I would be available for a piece of liver or a lobe of a lung.
I think that would be stretching it a bit. I mean, most of the donors are not that altruistic. I mean, they'll donate a kidney maybe. But
specifically to a loved one or somebody they're connected to.
What I was thinking of was, let's say you have a bunch of loved ones in this sort of a ring, right? And each one is paired with a particular donor who is not related to them, right? And so inherently doesn't have necessarily a very good match. But let's say somebody sitting around this table is about to donate to their loved one. They're also not a very good match. But if you swap those kidneys.
Yeah. So in other words, you're saying if you're in a position where you're going to be donating anyway, then why not pool so that you can match better?
Right.
And what are some of the areas that you're excited about in terms of research over the next few years where you're hoping to answer some questions about tolerance and transplantation?
Well, I think one area is certainly this area of what we call regulatory T cells. It's an area that I've been involved with. These are the things that mother induces in us. They're kind of like policemen. They're the ones that put the damper on an immune response to a particular tissue organ. People are thinking of ways of expanding these cells and then reinfusing them back into the patient to prevent them from rejecting an organ. I think there's excitement even now about some of the new drugs that they have. There's this one called, its brand name is Belatacept. It's part of the structure of these regulatory T cells. Sort of we've taken it out of the regulatory T cell and made it into a little molecule. It has to be infused once a month, but then the patient doesn't take drugs. They just come in once a month, get their infusion, and go home. It's got two very nice features. One is that you know exactly the patient shows up. You know exactly who's getting suppressed and who isn't. And the second thing is they're not taking nearly as much regular drugs.
Yeah, we haven't even talked about the economics of this whole phenomenon, but already you've indicated some ways in which the expenses can be curtailed.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think that in general we still suppress people with a sort of one-size-fits-all mentality. And I think the story about mother and the story about how we have a tendency to already be tolerant to her tells us that not everybody is a one-size-fits-all situation and that we have to tailor the immunosuppression to the person's age, to their pre-exposures, whatever their history is. And hopefully we can cut millions of dollars out of our health care that goes into unnecessary drugs for some of these people.
Will Burlingham has been our guest for this hour. We've been talking about organ transplants and advances in the way they're done. And, of course, you'll have to be back after we've had some more progress to report. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Norman and Emily.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.